You know, that's the kind of question that I probably know no better answer to that question today as there was 10 years ago. I do know major labels have become non-functional in the sense that technology has allowed most bands to be able to produce and put out their own stuff and actually market their own stuff to small corners of their world here, which is a very good thing. It spreads the bass around.
Welcome back to another episode of the First Crack Podcast. Hi, I'm Garrick Van Buren, and it's good to be back. It's good to be back. This is episode 67, a conversation with Minneapolis legend Steve McClellan, a man as legendary as the as First Avenue, the place he worked for 30-plus years. Currently, Steve is one of the things Steve is doing is working with a nonprofit in town, diverse emerging music organization. And I tried to nail him down on what the organization did and how it helps out independent musicians and independent venues. When we hit on so many other things, this is one of my all-time favorite conversations. Steve's a great guy. I had a great time with him. And we're going to jump right into it. Before we do, a couple of housekeeping things as per usual. Background music is generously provided by Jeremy Peller, and the First Crack Podcast is a Working Pathways production, workingpathways.com, home of the Work Better weblog. You can find out more about the First Crack Podcast, firstcrackpodcast.com. If you like what you hear, pop over to the website, leave a comment, rate this conversation, drop me an email, firstcrack@gmail.com. Also, the reason I'm talking to Steve, actually, is to get the dirt on the 35th anniversary First Avenue bootleg CD. And just in time for the holidays, why don't you pop over to first-av.com and pick it up for everyone on your list. These are previously hidden, you know, they're bootlegs. Seriously, they're bootlegs. 16 artists, you know, spanning the history of First Ave. Why don't you go pick it up again, first-av.com, and let's jump right into this conversation.
So the point being that if you're going to try to take a bunch of bands and create a win-win situation with venues with no draw, bands with no draw, mix them together with some kind of marketing ability of a nonprofit that's desperately needing money, the venue has more people than it normally does, or it's closed on the night we bring them in. The artist that's more established all of a sudden is playing in front of a new audience, being able to do things that they don't get to do in front of their higher-priced audience, new songs that haven't been heard before, or maybe a different type of music people don't want to hear their artists do. But they get to, with not the pressure of a big, high-priced pay gig, and put that together with developing bands, you know, hopefully they have enough talent to appease the audience. But I don't think what people realize when I realize this talking to the owners of the French Press, in developing bands, you know, sometimes you get a good show, sometimes you don't. You know, you could have the band before they fired their bass player, changed their name, and became better. But somewhere in that term, development means you have to play together, find out the chemistry isn't right, fire somebody, change the name, change whatever you're doing, add an instrument, subtract an instrument. To me, that's called developing.
And so do you do the firing and the instrument adding?
Oh, God, no, I'd never. That's like being a marriage counselor. No. But the band needs stages to perform on because in a basement when they're doing their rehearsal, you know, they can make mistakes and embarrass themselves. But it doesn't have the same impact to force the changes necessary to get wherever they're going. No, how could I be the one to change, break, fire? I would never get involved in that. That's a band thing. That's a marriage thing.
You had in a forum, I think on the, it was like the history of First Ave. You said you knew when a band was serious or not.
Oh. Well, I knew a band was serious when they concentrated on. Yes, I could tell a band. Well, I don't think I said serious, but when a band had some longevity to it is when they had chemistry, and when they performed on stage, there were buddies. They weren't. You can feel the chemistry in a band. You know, nothing's more depressing to watch artists, and you can use B-52s as an example, or you can use Violent Femmes as an example, bands that just haven't, they're not developing anymore, but they still need to use the band as a source of income because the individual products haven't carried. I think, and that doesn't make anybody good, bad, evil. It's not a judgment, a value judgment, who's right or wrong. It's just not happening anymore, and it's like a growth pattern thing. You know, well, let's move on. And in most businesses, I think you're allowed to move on, but in the music business, the consumer usually dictates whether you get to move on or not. I mean, how many artists do you know that are still trying to resurrect a career and their last hit single was 20 years ago? And they can't even get their own name in the front tension. They just always go, God, you were part of what? You know, I always kind of think of Alex Chilton is a wonderful, wonderful artist, and he's very talented, and yet he hasn't got the visibility to the mainstream to out-achieve when he was 19 or 17. I don't know, when he sang Ticket for an Airplane in the Box Tops. You know, to get to the mainstream, you have to go that back, far back in his career to have them recognize who Alex is. Now, that is so far gone that, A, not only must it be frustrating to ask two songs, that he wasn't, that's so far back in his history that he'd like to move on. I think that's a human, most people like to move on once they've accomplished something, they're overdone, they just don't want to repeat it. And when I say developing, that can be artists that have been together 5 years and draw 10 people, or a band that just got together yesterday and draws 10 people. It's not developing is not an age thing. It's the audience thing, because that's the thing that begins to fuel a band to start a get rid of their day job, make it a career, and you know there's so many, you know, I'm not being a musician myself. I mean there's other tangents here. You hear about the drummer that quits the band but then becomes a very good stage crew guy and then all of a sudden is one of the brightest tour managers on the road. I think of Randy Hawkins. Randy Hawkins is a very sought-after atmosphere, I think, is using right now. But Randy, when I first met Randy, he was the drummer in a band called Charlie Don't Surf. Randy, I don't think Randy went and played in any bands after Charlie Don't Surf, but he developed a career out of, you know, knowing how much trouble it is to carry drums, I suppose, back and forth and be the least appreciated member of the band when they're at that early stage when they don't have a stage crew and they all have to haul their own gear. But I guess that's, you know.
A point that I want to pull back on is what it looks like, what you think it looks like today for an artist, for a band, to be able to quit their day job. Are they signing with the major label? Are they doing something else to make it viable for them to move on?
You know, that's the kind of question that I probably know no better answer to that question today as there was 10 years ago. I do know major labels have become non-functional in the sense that technology has allowed most bands to be able to produce and put out their own stuff and actually market their own stuff to small corners of their world here, which is a very good thing. It spreads the base around, but there's also that attribute, I guess, why do you have to use a musician? I think anybody can quit their day job and get another job when that job achieves enough income where you set your income levels. You know, bands that make it for a long period of time and get used to $200,000 tour buses and can't get back in the van, is that a decision they're making or their careers are making? Well, I'm sorry, unless I can travel in a $200,000 tour bus, I'm out of the music business now. You know, that question, quit your day job, artists that want to achieve a career in music, let's say music. What about sculptors, painters, poets, writers? It's all the same. They're all struggling to make enough income, and depending on who you are and what you will live with and without, you know, there are some people that they don't need a lot of income. They're quite happy renting a small single room. They don't have a family. Healthcare is an issue, though. And they're content with that. And then there's other people that, you know, go raise big families or have big families, and then all of a sudden they need their income to go up. You know, that is totally a personal decision thing. I oftentimes just, this started out with demo. No, demo can't do anything to develop the band. That's what the band has to do. Demo has to be able to go out and provide experience stage presence in a business that's becoming ever more increasingly commercial. If you don't have a draw, don't call me. Close the doors unless the artist we book has a draw. Don't put anybody new on stage. It may hurt our image. It may hurt our... The best places for developing bands now are pretty much illegal because they let kids in under 21, they serve them beer, and they don't have to pay tax people. Okay? Then you get to do whatever you want. The only thing they better watch out for is that if any injuries occur and somebody wants to sue somebody, somebody's going to be in trouble. But to say they don't exist is a falsehood. You know, I know I remember reading when the bomb shelter was busted, it was an all-age room on Lake Street that had been open for several years, and something happened. I don't know what. I don't think it was a big deal. I don't think anybody got hurt. But the quote from the police department was, "And it's a good thing we snipped it in the bud." Like it had only been open for a couple weeks. Well, you know, if I had to giggle because I had known about the bomb shelter probably at least 3 years before this quote was in the paper, we nipped it in the bud. But anyway, I already got in trouble about talking about other clubs that are not quite, because, you know, that gets people in trouble. It's kind of like saying that small businesses don't call the inspectors when they do remodeling because they can't afford it. That doesn't happen if you're in the official now podcasting. Well, I can't say for sure. You can't bring me into court, and I can't name any small businesses that are not calling in. But, you know, my gut feels it's happening. Okay, that's my gut feel. And that's the way they have to compete with bigger businesses. But anyway, back to demo and bands. No. The band develops themselves. They fire their own people. They learn when they want to go in front of an audience, when they don't. They change their genre of music when they feel like it. And hopefully it's from the heart or what motivates them and not from a commercial trend. I see too many frustrated bands trying to repeat something they did one time that's never going to be repeated for a commercial dollar. They lose the creativity. They lose their motivation for doing what they're doing. They actually become non-musicians. They become somebody trying to do the clone kind of thing, trying to repeat something that... you know what? I can even take it back and say, no, I bet there are some guys out there that are purely happy doing the one song they made a hit of in 1968, Steppenwolf. No, let's not talk about specific bands. But, you know, maybe they are happy just riding on that one T-shirt, that one song, that one, doing rib fests and state fairs and wherever that crowd still goes. Soon, though, their whole audience is going to be dead. And then what does Steppenwolf do? Well, they'll be dead, too. So, I guess that all works out, doesn't it? And I'm not a music person. I tell people, well, I kind of hate music, but I know a lot of people that love it. And I don't mean I hate music. I hate the industry. The Frank Zappa thing, as soon as you record it, you've sold out, that you lose the moment of it. It's the whole... Now we can get into the CD thing, because on the liner notes, I said something like, it's certainly not one of the best quality CDs, because it's all bootleg songs.
Bootlegs from the First Ave.
From First Ave, yeah, or the 7th Street entry. All right, well, we can get into our podcast for what they need right now. There's two things happening. The demo, which is the nonprofit called Diverse Emerging Music Organization, is basically just a new name for DAMF, which was Developing Arts and Music Foundation. The good news is that it's just a name change. It's the same organization that was booking at the club since it went out of business last year, from 1999 until November last year. The thing that happened was when the club went down, the nonprofit almost went down. And a lot of people wondering where... I don't have an office at First Avenue. When it reopened, it kind of left me more independent of the club, and mainly to work with a nonprofit, which was floundering. And I can really attribute the success to the nonprofit right now to some board members who stuck on despite how things... Even the board members that got off the board, I have to say, stuck around when it wasn't fun anymore. You know, when you're on a music board, you're supposed to have fun. It's supposed to be about the music. Well, the last 2 years of that board was nothing about music. It was about attorneys filing with the state attorney general's office, what happened to the money, because when it went bankrupt, we ended up in bankruptcy court. We couldn't raise funds for a while until the right paperwork was gathered, which got lost in the whole closing of the club and me getting fired. And it became a horrendous year for people that really were on the board for purposes of music. you know, I'm thinking of people like Dale Schatzline, who would always come down to the club for anything. You know, Dale has been running the programming at Northrop Auditorium for 27 years, and he is a solid music lover. I don't know if people have truly met or dealt with Dale beyond his position over at Northrop, but he would show up for anything African, anything world beat, anything interesting that was out of the norm. And he was a music guy. He was a music guy. I don't know. I'm sure somebody will correct me if I say this wrong, but he was one of a group of people that were sent over to China a few years ago by the State Department to kind of shake hands with the Chinese on the arts. I don't know what means shaking hands on the arts. Usually I think anything when politicians get involved has to do with how much money can we take from you and how much money can you take from us and who comes out ahead. I this way there's elections and assassinations, both in the same breath. But anyway, the nonprofit demo. The beauty of the CD is demo is now been kind of jettisoned from the club because the new ownership down there put a lot of money to get it reopened and can't subsidize like the old company subsidized. So the bad news is there's no money with demo. They're broke. One of the major reasons for changing the name from a foundation to an organization is that all the musicians thought, foundation, they have money. Let's call them up and get some money. Well, with no money and still the mission of dealing with developing bands, not getting them when they're commercial and making money, but actually having to deal with them when there's a stage where they get to make mistakes on stage and fire one of their members, change their name five times before they actually become popular. That's the development stage. And more venues now, particularly we can get into this whole slant of the indie business end. It's like indie bookstores, indie coffee shops, anything indie, grocery stores, come on, name it. There's an institution that's slamming them. And a lot of it's the economic structure to me. But anyway, the two things that the nonprofit has discovered is that it's very hard out there right now for small nonprofits. I mean, I'm on the Cedar Board. I can't say Cedar Cultural Center. They changed their name. I still call it Cedar Cultural Center at times, and the rest of the board wants to wring my neck because they had a big study coming in. It was an update. You know, let's update our image. And what came down was they decided, let's just call ourselves the Cedar. Because they certainly have a great, you know, Bill Cabesco's been booking the Cedar for, God, I want to say 12 years now, and they've got a great history. But they're also one of the small indies that doesn't have the monies of a Walker or a Guthrie and are struggling to survive. And I think more stuff happens at a street level development-wise at the Cedar than you find at the Guthrie, than you find at the Walker. And that's not a, you know, there's a place for everything. I don't badmouth Clear Channel as a negative. It's just something that exists that creates an effect that, you know, you have to deal with if you're a small independent business. And to me, big business is something that's inherently part of America, right? And I don't, you know, yes, we could talk about a better administration office, but that would send us on a whole different other tangent because I don't believe in the two-party system either because I think you get almost the same thing. But I've got a lot of... Anyway, I think Winona LaDuc should be the president, not the vice president, and that's what I'm going to work on next election. But I actually went and saw her talk at the church about a month ago. She's always vital. In fact, now that we're podcasting, we can get off onto a technological jag. She said something. She's still working up on the White Earth Reservation. And me, I'm kind of living at my brother's house until I get my own home and drive my dad's car. And my office is all technology, my cell phone and the internet. I do the internet five times a day, and the cell phone loads up on me every time I stop and take a two-hour break with the ringer turned off. And she said something like she loves coming down to the cities and watching people have panic attacks when they can't plug in. And she was specifically talking about how dependent society has become on the internet and the, you know, the stuff that I like to brag about as an equalizer to the small indie. But if you really want to grab the problem, the social ills by the throat, listen to her talk a while because it goes to the problems with genetic engineering and what's happening in the wild rice culture up in the northern plains. We could go off on a tangent there. Let's get back to demo. Okay, this is all stuff. We'll get back to Winona next year's election. To me, demo, when it was resurrected itself after the demise of Committee Inc., which was the company that ran First Avenue up until November of last year, and the new company put up lots of money to reopen and could no longer subsidize or support the nonprofit. The good news is now the nonprofit is entirely free to go and work wherever they want, including First Avenue. The bad news, it doesn't have that solid financial base it did for years. So when the club decided to put together some kind of a 35-year anniversary CD, which came out on November 22nd, and available at Electric Fetus, which is, of course, for those who know, on right off Franklin and Clinton there by the freeway. Then there's a Roadrunner on about 43rd and Nicollet. I think I told people at NPR that it's on 46th and Nicollet. I'm going to correct that here on this podcast. Roadrunner. Treehouse Records, which, of course, is the old Orfolk Jokopus, which is on 26th and Lindale. They're all selling the CD. They're not making much money off it, but the money that is raised on the CD sales goes to the nonprofit that we're trying to get up and running and revitalized. And one of our next events at First Avenue is on December 14th, where we have a whole bunch of, since a lot of the bands that are represented on the CD. Oh, wait, we're talking about the CD. We might mention some of the people on it. In fact, well, not everybody. We put in a list of 300. We only had 16. That was one of my topics with Chris Roberts at NPR. Well, of course we didn't cover everything I wanted to. A, they pulled bands more commercially successful. And what I have, a problem I have with history is it takes things out of context. And back when Replacements used to open for Curtis A, making $25, Kurt was one of the primary names in the entry in that whole scene. And you can't pull somebody out 25 years later and even give any kind of, you know, the CD is basically to stir up people about the live performance day. Certainly if you wanted better quality music, you could get it. Certainly if you wanted a better representation of what your personal tastes are, it's probably not in this CD. It doesn't even represent the diversity at the club. It ended up, because of timing and commerciality, I think the picks were those that came because of a time limitation. We ended up with more of a rock CD. The Fela's not on it. There were bootlegs of Fela. Sun Ra wasn't on it. There were bootlegs of Sun Ra there. In fact, the beauty is that particularly back in the day, I'm not a record collector. I don't run around looking for that special bootleg that everybody talks about that they taped of The Cure in Berlin or something and know who recorded and how it got out. So we just went after, and you have to talk to SRO, Carrie and Steve over at SRO, who went out and got all the permissions from the artist. Hey, we got this bootleg. Will you give us permission to use it? It was kind of a win-win situation. The band could take something that they were presently not even aware of at times, put it to good commercial use by helping benefit a nonprofit that actually was involved in the development many times of these artists, and be able to do some good, get it on record. This bootleg is no longer totally a bootleg. It's now officially sanctioned by the band. And for me, the person that buys the CD, it more should just stir up not just the cut you're hearing. You know, if you're hearing Husker Du or Replacements, you should be also thinking, God, I remember that Outpatients performance. I remember Wilma and the Wilmers, and God damn it, I remember Curtis A. Remember, Replacements opened for Kurt, but Kurt wasn't commercially viable enough to get on the CD, but the Replacements were. Kurt still performs live in the market. Westerberg occasionally does, if you get in line early enough and want to pay the money. Kurt, on the other hand, will be performing at this party on the 14th, along with the Jayhawks, along with members of Golden Smog, Mike Watts flying in. And Mike's going to do Stooges because he's touring with Iggy Pop right now. So Mike's going to get up on stage. Anybody that does a Stooges number, Mike's right there. He's going to be up playing the bass line. I'm a huge, you know, Mike's a great guy. We should get him on the podcast. He's coming in a day early. I was going to get him a gig at McNally Smith, and now I found out I can't. Oh, he's wonderful. He's speaking of stream of thought. There is a guy that truly, truly represents. When you look at all the things that have kind of destroyed what sincerely the community, the music community in the early 80s, the so-called punk scene where it was more about camaraderie, a community, that doesn't exist today. That didn't exist after 87, I think. When did Alice in Chains or some of those bands first started coming out? I think that's when it started becoming more industry than punk. And I don't want to pick on Alice in Chains. Nirvana was part of that. Name them all. They were all part of, but it's all about the money now. Flannel shirts. And a lot of people say, well, the flannel shirts. A lot of people say Soul Asylum, Loud Fast Rules were wearing the flannel shirts. But actually, when you really look at it, I think Mike Watt was wearing a flannel shirt as the Minutemen before there was a Loud Fast Rules. But I'm not sure. I'll let the historians figure that out. I don't remember much from those days anyway, except for... But anyway, back to the whole notion of the CD. So when First Avenue consigned SRO to come in and needed a nonprofit, the obvious choice was to let Demo recoup the sales. So the CD came out November 22nd. There's plenty out there to purchase. It's Christmas time. You know, between actually Don Shelby talking about people to buy it on CCOAM last week and now Chris Roberts sometime this week. Well, actually Mark Wheat on November 22nd played bits of it and put it out into people's ears. To me, it's the people that buy this CD are more, it's something to stir up memories, not so much to sit and fine-tune or critique the professional nature of the bootleg or, you know, maybe for the collectors, God, I never had that song by so-and-so, and I'm glad I got it now. I don't know. I guess I kind of understand collectors because I collected baseball cards one time in my life, so it was important to have Lenny Green, even though, you know, Willie Mays at the time was more popular as a center fielder, but as a Twins fan, Lenny Green was important to me because there's thousands of bootlegs out there. And it wasn't because the club allowed it. It's because, you know, A, people were ingenious on how they did it. And as technology got better and better, it got impossible to stop. You know, I mean, but in the early 80s when a lot of this stuff was done, you had tour managers running around protecting their artists by confiscating tapes, confiscating tape recorders, confiscating anything they could get their hands on, whether it had anything on it or not. I don't remember how many irate customers were saying, he can't do that. And we'd have to go, well, yeah, he's a tour manager, he can. Now what they're supposed to do is just take the tape, you know, and erase it and give them back the blank tape. But inevitably, sometimes they got into scuffles about keeping the whole machine. You know, and it became a lot of much ado about nothing, really, because the bands that made the biggest stink, and I won't name any of them, were generally bands that people thought about for those 2 years, and now we don't talk about them anymore, and they don't appear on the CD, so they kind of disappeared in the wind. And I still remember one of the best performances I ever saw at the club was Roger McGuinn, who I wish we would have approached, and he was all about people taping his music because the most money he ever made, he said, was when he was with a major label. The most money that the records ever made, but he never saw that money. Columbia did. And now that he's on his own, the more people that can listen to his music and say, oh, wow, I kind of like that. I might go out and buy something. Now, he loves it when people pirate his stuff because he's a great songwriter. He's a great musician. And he deserves a lot more recognition. And believe me, back in the 60s when the Byrds put out their records on Columbia, I'm sure the artist didn't. It's kind of like, I use the analogy, what baseball players were making back then and what they're making now. I think there's some degree, a similar line to what musicians were getting when they got, because major labels had much more control of distribution back then. There wasn't nearly the competition. I mean, to me, what's happening economically is equally as bad in sports as it is in music. It's taking a select few, pounding the shit out of them, you know, and let's not even get it. At least in sports, you have to have the talent to stay on the roster, right? You have to, you know. And in sports, most major leagues will subsidize the minor leagues. In music, A, you don't have to have the talent. So I say some of your most talented people, it stands in the way of them actually making money because they don't like sitting on something. They like progressing. They like doing new stuff, and they never get time to nail themselves down as a commercial commodity or stay around along being something the industry needs them to be. They move on. And unfortunately, in music, you can make it without the talent. Where in sports, like I said, if you get paid multi-million-dollar contract, you better produce something out there on the field. You know, yes, maybe you get severance pay if you quit, but you get dumped readily if you're not producing talent-wise. And another thing, the music industry, besides being able to sell a lot of what I consider not quality product. But, you know, I guess it's in the eyes of the beholder, the listener. What they want to buy is quality. And if, okay, I'm not going to mention. Well, sure, you can say some of that stuff out there is absolute pablum. But people buy it. And it's image. It's marketing. It has nothing to do with talent. But where are we going with this? Okay, we're talking about demo. Nonprofit. Let's, ask the question.
I want you to finish your analogy on
Sports things that,
and major labels not supporting the minors.
Well, the minors, to me, is the independent club stuff that has to take risks to put something on stage, and that's not just in music. I use the example in the, you know, the arts. When something's risky and isn't commercially saleable, you don't see your big art galleries jumping on stuff unproven for sales. They got to jump on something that's proven some sales. Same thing I use with theater. If it's too risky and people are scared or don't want to see it or it doesn't draw, it usually, I always use the silly examples, those two Australian guys at penis puppetry. And so what happened was they, was it the Walker or the Guthrie? Somebody more knowledgeable than me has to talk about this, but they couldn't do it. They ended up having to do it kind of underground. I think Jam Productions ended up doing it, Mixed Blood, something. It was one of the underground theaters that it was, it's okay, you can do the penis poetry. You know, kind of silly to me that that's one of, but it's the risk thing. The Guthrie board isn't going to put up with penises on stage. You know, they've got an image to uphold, or the Walker, and it's just too risky. Of course.
So back to demo.
The demo. Okay, the nonprofit got spun out last year, and the CD that we're having, both the sales of the CD, and I'm supposed to mention, even though there's a lot of independent stores that are still selling it, and I think you have to go to the website to find the ones that I know about. I went into the stores to make sure the posters were up and stuff, making sure that they had equal footing with the Best Buy, because Best Buy was one of the big sponsors. They, of course, get to sell it, which to me is the worst thing in the world to do, the independent record stores, because they're the ones that support the club, and now Best Buy can come in under the ruse of a sponsorship and be able to sell the CDs. There's something that bugs me about that. But, again, outside my decision-making process, and I guess in defense of the decision, was that if it doesn't sell anything, the nonprofit gets no money. It's one of those... It doesn't matter about the process as long as you get the result. I don't buy that argument. You know, I think the process, no matter what the result is, if it violates some rules, shouldn't be done. And so be it if it doesn't go all the way. So anyway, that's my end of it. And that's, you know what? That's why we're talking, because you know stuff like that. The end justifies, I don't believe that, that the end justifies me. Unfortunately, in the case of the Best Buy, that was kind of the rationale. If we're going to do it, we're going to need to sell it. We can't sell it. See, my argument was we could sell it through all the indie stores and do just as well. And that was kind of shot down by the committee of people that know finance. I'm not a finance person, so I usually get shot down when I get involved in financial decision making. It's probably one of the reasons I don't have an office at First Avenue anymore either. I just never was my strength, and I think that's why I'm kind of out working with the nonprofit. Because it's an area that's not definable by the dollars that go into the till, and if it's like the long, to me, it's the long range effort and the reward. And a lot of times, when you look at it strictly in a financial thing, it's very short range. How can we make a dollar today? Okay, we don't care how, let's just do it. When in fact, the minor league team, a lot of times, something that's the research and development, they call it at the pharmaceutical companies. We need to spend all this money so that in the end we can come up with two things that work. Well, to me, in the music business, you've got to spend all this money, research, development. Somewhere down the line, out of 100 bands, two of them are going to make you money in the future. Now, unfortunately, going back to the sports analogy, in the music business, the major leagues, and I don't care if you want to call it Clear Channel at the top end, just pick up your Polestar major ticket sellers. I think Clear Channel has sold millions more tickets than the next competitor, which is either the California. I know Jam's somewhere in the top five. And Jam, to me, is a very, very solid independent music. The reason they didn't get bought up by Clear Channel is because they're too music-minded, too independent. And even though they're up there in the top 10 ticket sales, just because they're a very good independent that's maintained, it's kind of like, you know, you could say kind of like First Avenue and a lot of other clubs that are independent, and they've put up with the challenge of all the things that have changed the business, all the same stuff that, you know, sitting here in the Acadia looking at the Starbucks across the street, the challenge of what they have to deal with. And the whole system has kind of tended to be the haves and the have-nots, and the haves keep getting stronger and the have-nots get weaker. Because the whole system to me, the taxation, the rules, how nonprofits and profits are prevented from working together. They try to divide that line. I don't know. It's weird, but there is a huge change going on to me in the whole way things are being done, and the internet's the most obvious to point out to. But then just in terms of the way bands are developing. You know, the Edge right now in Minneapolis isn't even in the English language. You ain't going to read about it in your mainstream press. And I mean the city pages. Pulse is probably the closest independent music magazine that touches on non-English. But at the same time, they're still only in English. And you sometimes see the music. You have to go to clubs that aren't really registering right now. They're off the radar screen to the tax people, to the, you know, any English-speaking people, because the people at the door don't speak English. And that's a whole thing that's exciting. But boy, does that scare people that are in a set mode, like, this is the way we do business, and we're not going to change because it would cost too much to change. And they'll sit and wait until something else creates what they need to sell to make money. And that's what we're losing here. You got too many clubs, well, First Avenue being one and the 400 Bar, that have stopped opening on nights because they lose money when they open. Okay, where do new bands get a start? On the nights that, they don't have, certainly most clubs are going to grab the thing that sells tickets before they put on something that doesn't sell tickets. But the incentive to go and do, well, if you just look at the new band showcases, which a lot of people said have fallen into ill repute because they really didn't develop bands and they became too stale. Same music, same bands, playing the same thing every week. The diversity's gone. You know, the excitement's gone. And that's more of a programming problem than it is economic. The economic problem is people aren't going. I think the Fine Line still has a new band night on Mondays. Of course, you've got new bands going up at midnight on Monday. You know, a lot of bands say, well, bands shouldn't have to play free. At the same time, I have to give the Fine Line credit for still running a new band night when most venues have dropped it. You know, they're going back to ladies' nights or stuff. You know, well, how exciting is that? Well, that's pretty risky. Well, that's the when you look at the face of downtown, you know, everybody's making such a big deal about the hotel bar there because of what? I've been in there. It was too expensive. A lot of attitude. And I didn't see anything, you know, it reminded me of going to New York during the disco era and trying to get into Studio 54. Attitude always brings in crowds of people with attitude that want to, I don't know, I don't want to go there. I don't even know the name of the place. Demo is really the same nonprofit, but it's kind of a little different focus now. I mean, I say it's two steps. Try to create a win-win situation with the independent venues by getting people to come out and see new bands. Bands that don't have a buzz, that aren't following a trendy, whatever this week's, you know, pick hit hero is because of the press or, you know, some of the people out flaunting their merit. Because there's always more good bands than any market recognizes. In fact, a lot of bands like to make a huge point of, well, they didn't appreciate us in the hometown, so we had to go to England where we got big, and then they sold it back to us. In other words, and that is so true. That's why I always loved Pete Conway's band, Brits Out of America. Well, I know, because you can go to England, one small country, one TV station, two media, and you've got the country captured. In the U.S., you've got six countries you got to capture. You can't just make it in New York. That's called, you know, the Eastern, multiplex. And that's different than Florida, which is a Southwest country. And then you got the Great South country. And then you got the Southwest country. And then you have the Midwest country. And they're all different countries. In fact, I don't think a lot of people know, and I think it's still true today, but when I was more knowledgeable about record sales and stuff, I think Minneapolis was far closer to Boston trends than Chicago trends. Anyway, developing takes a lot of error, takes a lot of bad performances, takes a lot of firing of people before you get the right mix, a lot of stuff that's called developing. And I think a lot of artists, to me, if it doesn't develop, it sounds too much like programming, right? It sounds like, you know, the industry, they put a nice face on a nice thing and they get a nice producer to come in and they make something that's not really good, sound great, and then sell it to the masses, and the masses all buy it up and say how great it is. Now, anybody in the music business understands how easy that is to do, how easily deceived the general public is. Listen to any of your commercial radio stations for their format now and tell me how exciting that is for people that like Chain. I lost another argument of recent because I'm a huge KFAI fan, because if you want diversity, go to KFAI. But then you've got people saying, oh, they're all, somebody used the term blues, old-time blues Nazis, or hip, you know, people stuck in the old way and they don't. But when you really look at it, though, and you look at, you know, why did people turn off the radio when the Spanish or the Latin programming comes on? It's because they don't understand Spanish. Okay? And is that a fault of the station? Because the community here must realize to appreciate the music, you might have to learn another language. That's kind of a challenge. For old people like me, I took Spanish in college and forgot it all. Now I'm kicking myself in the butt saying, fuck. The whole thing about how risky it is to be a KFAI, because it isn't about commerciality. It's about diversity. It's about creating something that's risky in the community. Oh, my God, something I don't understand. Should I be exposed to that? You know, I mean, what's the matter with people? It's exciting that the city. Right now, I would think if you were an arts person, and I'm not an arts person. I actually don't like arts very much. I, you know, to me, it's a tool that you use to get people to work together. I like to use the music as a better way of bringing the Hmong audience together with Wisconsin deer hunters than deer hunting. Because if you just let them go deer hunt, bad things happen. Communication doesn't work really well out in the blinds of the, and I guess I've talked to people that are from that area, and not to be, some people might even consider that neck of Wisconsin redneck.
From there, I can concur.
Are you from there, too? So someone might not believe everything you read in the press about the 10 people talking about the one guy. Now, I think maybe overreaction might be a term used in this case. But again, I wasn't there. You know, I wasn't there. I do feel that it was a little bit slanted toward the majority and not the minority in this situation. And the only thing I can say, it's a bad situation. People shouldn't die. You know, then I question, though, how many of those people voted for Bush and are behind what's going on in Iraq right now. Oh, you know, we're on a political tangent. We got to back off here. Let's go back to demo. So a lot of the small indie nonprofits to me are suffering the same thing as the small independent record stores, a lot of small coffee shops. They're forced with, you know, trying to, I mean, we're sitting here at the Acadia. Ted, probably because of what he's doing right now with original music, is probably developing more artists than any Starbucks selling CDs off their whatever the new program they got going. But Starbucks also gets to make a lot of money on these artists because I read somewhere where now they're developing artists. That's an oxymoron. Isn't that the term I want, oxymoron? Starbucks, developing artists. No, they're cloning music and serving it up pablum-wise to the masses that like pablum with their coffee, I get. It's too risky to go out, see something new, see something they haven't heard 75 times in the last 3 days on one station. It's you know, I always say the problem isn't Clear Channel. The problem isn't, you know, you can even say, although I grit my teeth at this, the present administration, it's the people that vote, the people that buy records, the people that listen to 93X or Cities 97 before they listen to KFAI. The people that choose to buy their records at Best Buy instead of the independent record store. And what it really does is make it easier for the institutions to spend less money developing. Why go and put a lot of research and development into creating something that people won't buy? Why don't we just take and put something that looks like last year's sales product into this year? I don't know where we're at on this conversation, but the CD, the sales go to demo. We've talked about diverse emerging music organization. The hurdles that small indie businesses have to deal with in terms of just staying alive financially. As a little plug for, there's a guy named Papa John Kolstad who's ran Mill City Records for years in Minneapolis. He's on the board of directors of a thing called Metro IPA, Independent Business Association, or Alliance. And along with him is David, and I can't even pronounce David's last name, but the guy that owned Ruminator Books, David. I'll get his name here. It's right on the back of this brochure. David Unowski. Okay, that's why I can't pronounce it. It's U-N-O, Unowski. Well, David's also on the board of this independent business thing. And basically, it's to make a more level playing field from a legislative, from an economic basis, so that the indies can survive despite what the institutions are being able to do. It's only been around about 6-8 months. But to me, it's not just the music business that is watching where the street level stuff is being, you know, put out of business. It's the old, in a bigger sense, it's that I went and saw a documentary that they had go about the whole Walmart effect. They come in, they open a store, and then all the little mom-and-pop stores on Main Street, small-town USA, go away. And what you lose is, A, from a financial stand, I have a poster here that says when you start buying, stop buying locally, there's something, I don't know the exact specs, but there's some poster saying that when you buy from a big chain store, 23 cents on the dollar stays in your local economy, where if you buy from an indie, 64 cents stays in the local economy. Now, most people trying to, you know, like I go to Cub Food because there is no more independent grocery stores. Now, I am trying, people are trying to convince me, well, you know what, there's the independent co-ops, you know, like, but they're so expensive. Right now I'm underemployed and I, two kids, I need the cheap discounts. But in a certain sense, sitting and listening to the argument going on probably is in my better, you know, long range, this is the long range, short range, to support the local and not the chain, even if it's a monetary loss right from the start. I mean, for the short range. And that goes into why the developing of the music, if you want to get back to the music, is so difficult a thing because it doesn't make immediate money. There is a cost. And why should you pay that cost if other people develop it and then you can make the money on it afterwards? Or you can clone it and you don't even need the new stuff. It's too risky. It doesn't draw. Go ahead and just sell them what you sold them last year under a different name and a cover. I'm simplifying this, and I'm sure everybody realizes I'm simplifying this, but to some degree it's so true. And so back to the mission, there's another mission that I see the music, and this is the one, first you've got to develop a base, get a financial base, and start developing bands. Then the second step in my mind for the demo kind of mission is to take and utilize that developing music as a tool to bring the different neighborhoods together. You know, instead of having people shooting each other across wire fences, maybe have them sit around and listen to their neighbor. Or, you know, this is to break down some of that very, very parochial attitude that exists between. And it's not just, I'm not just talking about us transplanted Europeans that have lived here all our lives. I'm talking about the different, if you go talk to some people about the differences between the different Somalian clans. They've got barricades between each other. Or you want to talk about how the Liberians feel about the Nigerians, who feel about the other African minorities. It's, you know, it's, or you want to talk about the Cuban Hispanic community versus the Puerto Rican versus the Mexican. Now, certainly because the Mexican is the largest population, it's what we're exposed to in the market. But even to understand the subtle differences is a learning experience. And if you're going to live in the neighborhood, live in the community, it's kind of like, well, become part of it. Or do what a lot of people do, move about 80 miles out of town and think it'll never reach you.
This has been Conversation Number 67 of the First Crack Podcast with Steve McClellan. This is Garrett Van Buren saying thanks for listening. Thanks for making it all the way through. Man, that was a long one. Good stuff, though. Good stuff. Head over to firsttrackpodcast.com. Check out the show notes. You'll find links to all the stuff we talked about. And leave your comments and thoughts on what Steve talked about. And be sure to pick up a CD. Help out the demo this holiday season.